gorgeous. And of course, Huya Madhav will fund it. And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, honorable members. In terms of the program today, we had agreed in our last meeting, you'll recall, that we planned a workshop, Stroke Orientation Week, and we identified the role players that were involved up to this point to just Honorable Masuta, just to bring members up to speed with the politics around the formation of this, or the establishment of this committee, the powers and functions and responsibilities, the rules, and we'd also ask those that had done initial research in terms of best practices internationally to share that with us. But ultimately, the politicians are going to take decisions on these matters. We'll get recommendations from the various stakeholders. We will be able to ask questions of clarity and or contribute. The end objective, honorable members, is for us to develop a program for this committee. And clearly that program will be informed by our workload and our need for further training, if there is need for further training. So at the end of the day, hopefully this will inform Jessica and her team to draft a proposed work program for us, or committee program for us, which we then can ratify on the basis of the information that we will have shared today. So that will be the first decision that we have to take as a committee. The second decision, obviously, is going to be, when do we want to meet? We had agreed in the last meeting that because of the nature of the composition of members, all of us are otherwise occupied most of the day, it is preferable that we meet this time, this kind of time. And we'll try and make sure that it's during the week so that you don't have to reschedule your flights to your constituencies and so on. But again, that is going to be members to decide. So if you give us an indication of which are the preferable days, Jessica and company will then be able to come up with a draft program in terms of which days we meet and how often do we meet. Is it weekly? Is it once a month? Is it fortnightly? That will obviously be informed by the workload as well as the time constraints that we might have in terms of producing reports for Parliament on some of these matters. So really that's what it's about. Very informal. Our program has made provision for input for about 20 minutes or so, and then for engagement. We wrap that section up, we go on to the next one, and so it's very informal. I think members can just interject and shout and contribute as you wish, because this is really an orientation more than a committee meeting as such. So we'd really want it to be as interactive as possible, so that the end product is owned by all of us and not by Jessica and the support staff. So let's take this opportunity to welcome all of you. Also to thank those that on short notice have agreed to come and assist us, Mr. Jenkins, Zanele, Masuta, Marina. I think others will join us as we go along, as would members of the committee. I know that the NCOP chairperson will join us in a few minutes. I'm sure Mr. Bloom will join us. The only apologies that we have received, as Mr. Sneeman is hospitalized, Mr. Kurunov is debating in another EPC right now. And the third one is Ms. Sue van der Merwe has got an engagement that she can't get out of. So we're expecting everybody other than those three. And of course, Mr. Mansoura, who we had asked to do the rules and standards, is otherwise occupied, but he has sent somebody to do it on his behalf. So with your permission, ladies and gentlemen, are we happy with the program and the way we're going to unfold? And if we are you happy that we proceed?
Yes.
Can we continue?
Yeah.
All right, thank you. By the way, I'm not driving the ship alone. As you know, the co-chairperson is also going to help us steer the ship, and we will manage the process from the front in that session. So we will do it jointly. Thank you very much. Welcome. And Mike, it is 10 past as per our program. And if you could do it by 1:30 at the absolute latest, it'll allow 10 minutes for members to then engage with you until 22. So it's about 20 minutes, Mike, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Chair, I'll spare you the pain. I'll probably be more brief than usual. I have a notorious teacher for trying to break from it. Afternoon, Mike. I've been asked to share institutional memory, having chaired the committee that developed an instrument which I assume everybody has copies of, entitled Interim Report of Joint Subcommittee on Delegated Legislation on Scrutiny of Delegated Legislation.
Just before you continue, Mike, have members got copies of that document? I have not received it. Oh, it's the original?
Yes.
Okay, the interim report. That's the very first document that we've received. The quite thick one. So that's what Mike will be talking to. Yeah, there are a few copies if members need copies. Can we get an indication if members need copies? If they do, just indicate and Jessica will get it to you. It would have been one of the very first that came with notices.
In any case, I wouldn't expect people to read through the whole document in the next few minutes. So I'll just talk broadly to it, and you know, in due course, colleagues can go through the document. And the idea is just to facilitate your interaction with the document as you begin to engage with the work. And of course, the rules that were adopted following, which were adopted by the Rules Committee, that govern the functions and the mandate of this committee. And those would also include, amongst other things, the criteria to be used by this committee in executing its mandate, which, as the name goes, is to scrutinize delegated legislative instruments against a set of criteria which are outlined in the rules. I'll ask the table staff to assist in areas where detail may be required, such as specifics relating to the rules that govern the mandate of the committee. But this is a broad introductory input. This exercise dates back more than a decade. I myself inherited the process which had started back in the mid-90s somewhere. It was 1997. You're not even there yet. Yeah. But essentially, all of this derived from a provision in the Constitution, Section 101, in the case of the NA, and Section 140 in the NCOP. Section 101 refers to regulations, proclamations, and similar instruments of subordinate legislation, which in this context we refer to as delegated legislation. And it says that, first of all, this form of legislation must be made more accessible to the public. But secondly, in sub 2 it says that Parliament may pass legislation regulating how it is going to ensure that and the extent to which this kind of legislation should be tabled before it, firstly, and the extent to which it should be approved by Parliament before it becomes law. Now, the context to this is that, as you know, under our constitutional democracy, under the principle of separation of powers, the power to make law rests fundamentally in lawmakers, and the power to execute or implement the law, obviously, in the executive, and of course, adjudication of disputes arising out of the operational implementation of that law is a matter for the courts, who have the final say in interpreting what that law is. So that's where the principle of separation of powers lies. Now, this is an area which is then a departure from that norm, which says, however, Parliament may, in its own legislation, delegate some of its lawmaking power to the executive, to the extent it is fit, of course, to make further law, where it would then deal with some issues which are more specific and more detailed, which Parliament does not want to waste its time, essentially, or, you know, burden itself with having to plow through. And in reality, you find that the law that gets generated, which you may call secondary law, subordinate law, delegated law, can have far-reaching implications in governing the life of the citizen. And hence the Constitution deemed it fit to have a provision that says, therefore, Parliament reserves the right to scrutinize whether what the executive, having been delegated this power, has, in making those laws, complied with certain standards which Parliament then imposes. So that's where your criteria come in. So the idea really is not for Parliament, having delegated the lawmaking function, to then indirectly exercise that legislative function itself by going back into the detail of the legislation and starting to decide whether they agree with the policy choices or disagree with the policy choices in that subordinate legislation. Because having delegated the power, they are saying that we need not do this exercise ourselves. We're handing the function entirely to the executive, as long as you comply with certain of the standards which we have set for you. So the purpose of this committee, therefore, is to police, if you like, compliance with those norms of standards which would have been set in the criteria, and that would be the parameters of the mandate of the committee in terms of what it is that it would therefore be looking for in evaluating whether a set of regulations comes after or not. In other countries, a committee like this would be assisted by an experienced lawyer, sometimes even a retired judge, because of the complexity, the legal complexities of some of the kind of regulations that you deal with. The other issue is that you may wake up to discover that in terms of content, you might find that regulations have a lot more content than the principal legislation. So the issue of volume of work, you know, might have a bearing. So the idea is to have an expert or a team of experts that do all the donkey work and identify issues that need to be brought before the attention of the committee, rather than for the committee to plow through all the nitty-gritty and the minutiae, because as politicians we really don't have the time to do that kind of. But then you need a competent person who knows what they're doing to really support a committee of this kind. Now, one of the issues, of course, that we look at, let me just start by saying that you would notice how is delegation actually done. Usually we have what we call an enabling provision in an act of parliament. The enabling provision would be that clause that you always find in a bill that says the minister may make regulations with regard to the following. Then it lists the whole list of matters in respect of which the minister is empowered by parliament to make regulations. Now, one of the functions, of course, of the committee like this is to immediately check whether indeed the minister acted within the parameters and the scope of that enabling provision in making the regulation. So if the minister makes regulations on matters for which she has not been specifically mandated to make, in law we say those regulations are ultra vires. They are outside powers. He was not, or she was not delegated to deal with those matters, dealt with the matters, so those regulations are not valid. Very straightforward. But there would be other criteria which are a little more complex, you know. Is this delegated legislative instrument amounting to over-regulation to the extent that Parliament would not be particularly happy with? Because the power to regulate the people, their behavior, their conduct, and their transactions, their dealings, is a inherent authority of Parliament. It's a political choice that vests in Parliament. So Parliament may have deliberately chosen in principal legislation to relax regulation, but the executive might choose to tighten regulation to the displeasure of. But I'll not go to all the criteria that are listed there. I mean, they're fairly straightforward. It would be working people. I'm just giving a taste of the kind of issues that you may have to deal with. We also then distinguish between what we call delegated instruments of a legislative nature versus those of an administrative nature. Now, you've noticed that in almost every act where provision is made for regulations to be made under that act, in the definition section, the very last definition, there would be words like, this act includes all regulations made under this act. Now, what that clause does, it effectively elevates the status of any regulation that the minister would have made under the act to the status of legislation, but subordinate legislation. So effectively, when you deal with those regulations, you treat with them as if they were law in the same manner as you would treat the act itself, except that because it's not passed by Parliament, legally it occupies a slightly more inferior status, and I'm not going into detail of in what way does it in practice become inferior to principal legislation. So that is one way of proving that indeed the regulations are legislation. We say so because we distinguish from instruments that the lawmaker may have referred to in the law, which are not necessarily intended to be legislation. For example, in the Act, the minister may be empowered to issue guidelines, circulars, and other instruments of an administrative nature to facilitate the implementation of the legislation. Now, those instruments do not acquire the status of subordinate legislation. They remain administrative instruments, and in law, their status is even more inferior than that of regulation. But of course, regulations are not the only instruments. In some instances, we find not ministers per se, but institutions within the executive that are also empowered in the legislation to make delegated legislation, such as your councils and other regulatory bodies, nursing councils, medical councils, who usually do not make regulations, which are normally made by them, but would make a gamut of subordinate legislation called rules. It's still delegated legislation. It's still the extension of law. They're not just purely administrative. I'm told that recently the Constitutional Court, in some ruling, downgraded delegated legislation to pure administrative instruments. I am not sure. I haven't read the judgment. Jenkins and them, and the big legal minds here may assist in that regard. The implications of that judgment might be something for the committee to look at, if indeed there is such a judgment. Now, I touched on the issue of criteria which you then need to determine whether regulations are compliant. Let me touch on an aspect relating to the enabling provision itself that says that ministers or boards may make rules or regulations. One of the aspects that I envisaged in this mechanism is that when a committee is considering a bill and there is a clause that delegates, the mandate of this committee could include scrutinizing that enabling clause to see whether is it unduly giving away too much of Parliament's lawmaking authority to the executive, to the extent that Parliament would not be happy with. You have regulation clauses that say, and the minister may regulate any other matter which in his opinion it deems necessary or fit. In having set a whole list of criteria tightly and carefully, that suddenly right at the tail end there's a thing that basically opens the whole thing up, which means he didn't even need to set those parameters for the minister. You may as well have just had one sentence and say the minister can make regulations on anything he likes. So those kind of clauses you usually look out for, because clearly that in a way compromises Parliament's inherent lawmaking authority in a manner that you might find to be inappropriate. Now, as I indicated, the Constitution says that Parliament may make legislation to regulate, firstly, the issue of tabling of this instrument in Parliament, and secondly, the issue of approval by Parliament before this delegated legislation can become law. Now, currently, this is an environment where there isn't a umbrella legislation that regulates the matter. Each committee, if it deems fit, will outline a procedure that says this regulation must first be tabled in the assembly before it becomes law. Some bills will say the regulations must be tabled and approved by a portfolio committee before it becomes law. Some clauses would say both houses must approve the must be tabled. All thousands before it can be covered. So there is a varied set of procedures depending on how that portfolio committee or select committee felt at the time. So there is no uniformity. The only semblance of uniformity in our law at this point is that it's some old act, the 1957 Interpretation Act, which requires, and to the best of my knowledge it's still law, requires that at least all delegated legislation must be tabled. I don't know whether it says in assembly or in parliament. In parliament. So at least you have that safeguard, but that's all it says. So tabling does not necessarily mean approval. So that is where matters are. Hence is a provision that I referred to that empowers parliament to actually come with legislation that's going to be of an umbrella nature that sets a uniform standard. But to get to there, obviously, more research would have to be done to look at the desirability and feasibility of that option. Because it could have a serious clogging of the system. It could have the Reserve Bank governor unable to issue certain things to the detriment of the economy because the system is clogged and you are not able to approve those regulations that governs monetary policy or whatever in good time. So those are some of the issues that one has to reckon with as one perfect the system. Hence, the word interim scrutiny mechanism. The idea was that this is going to be a trial run. We're going to work with status quo in that at best we can monitor the enabling clauses as committees pass legislation, deal with the approval of regulations where approval in terms of existing bills is required, and not necessarily extend ourselves to deal with every single instrument. I am not quite sure on that score whether we have any basis to be able to approve or insist on approving delegated legislation that the principal act does not require to be approved. Because then on what legal basis would we be insisting? But possibly what we can do going forward is to ensure that any bill that has delegated legislation must provide for a clause that requires approval. So those are some of the issues that the committee would have to deal with. I'm just trying to check whether I haven't covered any matter that I consider to be significant to highlight. I think I'll pause there.
Can I just ask you to repeat that any bond which has regulations must?
Yeah, I'm saying that what you may want to look at going forward, because part of your mandate really is to monitor. Marina will look exactly at what the regulation, what the rules empower you to do. But to monitor the enabling provision of any bill going forward to make sure is it included? Yeah, in your bill. So that you monitor what portfolio committees are throwing into the bill in this area. If you feel that there's a need to, moderate the way in which you're giving away things, But further on, you may need to deal with the issue of whether you want to make sure that every bill specifies that before the regulations take effect, they must not only be tabled as per the Interpretation Act, which is already provided for, but must actually be approved, which is not necessarily provided for anywhere in the law, unless that bill specifically requires it, and begin to develop a standard and a uniformity ahead of eventually developing a all-encompassing umbrella act similar to the Interpretation Act that subsequently requires everything to be approved. But what you also do is, I think, I don't know if the rules provide for it. What you usually do, you set time frames for yourself where you say, if you have an approved stay within 30 days, then the instrument, once promulgated, takes effect to prevent a situation where Parliament, like it did with this very same matter, sits with the regulation for 11 years. Mm-hmm. And for 11 years, you have an act that does not have the requisite regulation to implement it. It could be a disaster. Just to illustrate a point, I mean, the social assistance might, in terms of which grants are paid to the 15 million beneficiaries, without those regulations, you can't pay a cent to anybody. So you can imagine those regulations sitting in the south, and the poor people out there suffering from starvation because Parliament is still considering the regulations that govern the payment of grants. Much of the detail relating to that system of grants, criteria and all, is actually contained in the regulations rather than in the principle. So just to illustrate how serious a delay can cause on the governance of the country. Maybe I'll pause there, and I don't know how I've done with time, but if I exceeded, I apologize. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, you just far exceed, Mike, if we're going to be strict on time. The next one starts in 5 minutes if my watch is not deceiving me. But let's allow, this is really just the background and giving us where the politics of it are. And I thought it was very self-explanatory, and it will be work in progress as we go along. But if members want to comment, ask questions, you can do so. But short of any questions, we will then move on to the next one. Any questions to Mike? Happiness?
Yeah, I have a question, but I don't know if it's, it just tell me if it's not the right place. Okay. Mike, you know, you're suggesting the way forward, but how far back do you think we should be going? I mean, would it be in the, you know, from the time the recommendation has been made in the ATRM? Because this is obviously as a result of the recommendations in that report. Would it be like 2009, the beginning of the third parliament, or when? What? And who can request the scrutiny? Would it be the same principle, for example, like a private member, where an MP would be able, or would it? How would the referral to the committee be?
It's okay.
Before you continue, are there any other questions? They might overlap, but it's not a problem, because if they overlap, then any other expert here can give his views on it, because really you're empowering MPs. At the end of the day, we're going to take the decision, but we want to take an informed decision. So are there any other questions that members want to throw on the table? And we'll allow it to all the experts that have been invited, just to give us your views, so that we can take them from there. It doesn't seem so. So, Mike, we give you the first bite.
No, there is no invisible retrospectivity in this whole thing. Because you're dealing with delegated legislation that is to come. You're not dealing with legislation that's already in place. Because legislation that's in place for really long, that's water under the bridge. Whichever way it came about, there was no instrument such as this before that. So the law came into effect, unless there's some pending rule, which upon assumption of your rule, still needs to be looked at. There might be bills that are currently in a pipeline that you may already want to start looking at in the light of the mandate as well. Yeah, just the one point really is, I haven't emphasized much on the area of making delegated legislation accessible. That's something that you probably may look at going forward. But the idea is that in due course, there should be a system that is developed probably or ideally by the executive itself,
where they are able to properly index all delegated legislation under their administration that is currently in place, just to comply with the constitutional requirement of accessibility, because it's a lot more difficult to find regulations than it is to find legislation. EPATA was that basically has a compilation of all laws that are currently in force, but you don't have a similar compilation of regulations. You have to first find out whether there was ever regulations made under that act, and then go and find the gazette that contains those regulations. So they're a lot more inaccessible compared to principal legislation. So the idea really is to find a way to improve. So you may want to raise the issue with the executive to say, engage around how can you collaborate going forward gradually to develop a new way in which regulation and other delegated instruments can easily be accessed by members of the public. And that could even include issues of language, issues of form in which it's written. Many of those things sometimes become so technical and not of formulas and stuff. So guidelines may be another way in which and little booklets may be another way of really making things accessible to the public. But I think that's also moving into another realm about how do we make governance generally accessible to the people.
All right. Thank you, Mike, for jotting down for members of parliament. I think the first thing that we're going to have to discuss at some point is the issue that Mike is raising about developing a uniform standard and so on. Because as Mike was saying, some laws say table, others say don't table, and then we must, at the political level, decide that, look, all legislation must come through this committee or whatever. So I think that's something that we're going to have to discuss and debate at some point very soon, because that is going to have a direct impact on our workload. And then Mr. Jenkins or other people, Mike, you spoke earlier on of a Concord ruling that relegated or stroke questioned delegated authority vis-a-vis administrative and or otherwise. Mr. Jenkins, if you have any information on that one, you need to tell us. Because indeed, if Concord has said all delegated legislation is administrative, it means we don't have a function as this committee. If I'm understanding it correctly. So somebody must do that research for us. Indeed, if it was there, in what context was it raised? Because that's going to assist us. And you've taken us forward, Mike. I mean, we'll discuss it as politicians, but for me, I think I agree that it has to be forward-looking. We can't go and do it retrospectively. So the sooner we get our act together, from that day to then become law, and we'll talk to the leader of government, business, or somebody else to help us in indexing these things as they come down. But we'll leave that to Jesse and her people in terms of developing some pre-warning system or early warning system for us. Thank you very much, Mike. With your permission, ladies and gentlemen, if you can just note those things that we think that we want to come back at a political level at some point, and in our first meeting, that will be our discussion. If we then can ask Advocate Mike, thank you very much. You're welcome to stay with us and contribute. You're free to leave if you've got other business. There is dinner that is being served later on, and you're more than welcome. Can we allow Advocate Jenkins to do his presentation? And that session will be chaired by my colleague.
Thank you, Honourable Co-Chairs, members, colleagues. Bit of a daunting task after that very eloquent presentation of Advocate Masuta. I think let me start by that Concord judgment. I will look for it. It's not on the tip of my tongue. I know there was a judgment where someone relied on policy to prove a point in court, and the court said that that's not law. And I don't know if that's the same case, but the delegated legislation is law. It's a legislative function which Parliament has delegated to the executive, as Advocate Masuta has said, and these things have to be written down. We know that the founding provision, chapter 1 of the Constitution, says that we have a country that's ruled by law, or is under the rule of law, which goes to a lot of the questions that has come up, Honorable Co-Chairpersons. One, whether there can be retrospectivity, or when can we approve or disallow legislation. The answer, I think the simple answer, there might be exceptions, is usually when it's written down in the empowering enactment. So that's the crux of it. I will return to that. I was asked just to make a presentation on the constitutional imperative establishing this committee. And there's a general imperative, specifically for the National Assembly, but we know it's implicit in the constitution with the NCOP as well. Section 55, which says that the National Assembly must provide for mechanisms to ensure that executive organs of state in the national sphere of government are accountable to it, and must maintain oversight over the exercise of national executive authority and the implementation, or including the implementation of legislation. So there we can see specifically the implementation of legislation. If Parliament has passed legislation and the President has assented to it and it's become effective, to say that the executive must make certain regulations or may make certain regulations, preemptive, and the other one is discretionary, this Parliament can look at, and this is what this committee must also do. There are certain legislation, certain acts which says that you must make regulation, as I said. In those instances, that act cannot come into operation unless those regulations are made. And it becomes a bit of a spider's web now. Because we have an act that's passed, we've asked the executive or delegated certain functions to the executive to say, you must do it. We must monitor that. This committee is instrumental in that, and the houses must make sure that the executive has passed that legislation. And the legislation cannot become operative until it's passed. So the committee must, in that research it wants to do, whether to say generally all regulations must be approved by Parliament, think of these implications. There's further issues that I will highlight in my presentation, which I'll come back to, where we must make sure whether we want to approve or disapprove regulations, or whether we just require them to be tabled in Parliament. As it stands at the moment, each Act provides separately for that. Advocate Masuta referred to the Interpretation Act. The Interpretation Act requires that the executive submit a list of all the notices and government gazettes that they've used to publish the regulations that they've made in terms of the Act of Parliament. So that's not necessarily the specific set of regulations, the content of which we want to look at and evaluate against the scrutiny criteria. It's just a list. So it is a change, a total change of legislative function, specifically delegated function, that we're looking at here. Certainly, I think legislation must be made public. That's what the Constitution requires. If it's not made public, it cannot become operative. So when it comes to delegated legislation, the same principle applies. The question is just, does it get submitted to Parliament as the representatives of the people and the provinces? And that is an unanswered question, believe it or not. As I say, the Interpretation Act asks for a list, and I've emailed with Jesse during the week about that list. That list is there. We can see what regulations have been made. We can look at them, but it's water under the bridge in as far as those have become operative. So that's the oversight function of Parliament as such, but specifically the National Assembly. Section 92 of the Constitution also requires that members of Cabinet are accountable collectively and report on their functions, and that's implicit there, also their functions as delegated legislature. And then specifically Section 101 of the Constitution, which Advocate Masuta has referred to, which says that national legislation may specify the manner in which the regulations must be tabled or approved by Parliament. And that's your basic framework, why the committee is here and what Parliament is supposed to do. So the questions that have come up have been asked, in my opinion. One of them is, should we always request tabling? Or should we request tabling in specific instances, and should we request approval? Not request, should we include in the mandating provision, in the enabling provision in the Parent Act, if you want to call it that, that these regulations can only come into operation after approval, or if Parliament doesn't approve it, they come into operation 30 days later, and so forth. However, it is critically important that we get a firm grip on this, Honourable Co-Chairperson, because as I said, there has been one case, a pharmaceutical manufacturer's case, where an act has come into operation. It has repealed other acts, where after it was taken to court by the pharmaceutical manufacturers, which said that the regulations that are there to set out what scheduled drugs or how long do we get approval of these drugs are not there yet, so how can the act come into operation? And the court struck down parts of that act, which created a huge vacuum. In fact, for a time period, a lot of scheduled drugs were legalized in South Africa. But it luckily didn't cause the collapse of the country, but it's a serious matter. So as I said, there's nothing at the moment which is general, which we want to do. There are specific acts. I want to just use some examples that we have seen. We see that some acts authorize a member of cabinet in consultation with the board or not to make certain regulations and then to table it in parliament. We can look at the Immigration Act. Speaks of consultation with the Immigration Board before those regulations can come into operation. So it's after consultation with a board, those acts will come into operation. So those regulations come into operation. The Promotion of Administrative Justice Act requires that certain regulations must be made and others may be made. And those that must be made must be approved by Parliament. And all regulations must be tabled in Parliament. So you get these mutations of what we're talking about here, Honourable Co-Chairperson. Similar to the Promotion of Access to Information Act, well, that just requires that all regulations that are made are tabled in Parliament. So that's a rather different, as I say, different mutations of the enabling provision in a parent act. And this is what this committee will have to look at and see if there's not a more, let's say, in line with the constitutional mandate that was given to Parliament, isn't there not a way to make delegated legislation easier for the public to understand, even easier for lawyers to access? I mean, we have to pay to access delegated legislation at the moment. It's not freely available in government gazettes on the net. So there's an issue there. The thing that I've specifically asked during the week when I prepared this to look at, one was retrospectivity, which we have now spoken a bit about, and that's retrospectivity in the sense of, can we go back to regulations that have been passed? Can we go back to acts of Parliament that's been passed and look at those regulations and approve or disapprove? And the answer is no, unless you've changed the enabling provision in that statute. If you change the enabling provision, one can go look at those regulations. Another point I've been asked to look at, well, let me first finish on the retrospectivity, Honourable Co-Chairperson. There's also the point of, can a minister make a regulation that operates retrospectively? For instance, we're making regulations at the moment, I believe, on the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, new regulations. Can the minister make regulations there that will have retrospective effect? The answer to that would be not, unless the Parent Act allows that minister to make that. And in criminal law cases, the Constitution disallows it. Section 35 of the Constitution says no criminal provision can be applied retrospectively. But a lot of what the National Treasury is doing, in terms of its tax laws, operates retrospectively. Not necessarily through regulations, but tax laws usually get passed after the beginning of the financial year, but the tax provisions are implemented retrospectively. It's quite an interesting thing. The other point I was asked to say something on is transitional arrangements. This is specifically pertinent when you look at this court case I've discussed, and this committee would have to look at this court case, in my opinion, quite carefully, because it says a lot about regulation making, this pharmaceutical manufacturer's case. Transitional provision is to prevent that situation from happening. It usually says, here's an act, we want to repeal it. But the regulations made in terms of that act will remain valid until we replace those regulations with new regulations. That's in simple a transitional provision. We see it most famously in the Financial Management of Parliament Act, which says that until we've made new supply chain management regulations in terms of this act, our old supply chain management regulations or policy will continue in force as if it is a regulation. And it falls under a regulation and becomes part of this act, as Advocate Masuta has pointed out. So it's part of legislation. Co-chairpersons, before I go over my time, let me say something quickly on why it's important to think about approving or disapproving regulations. Specifically, I've mentioned Section 146. Section 146, in fact, Section 146 to Section 150 of the Constitution is there to prevent and manage conflict between legislation that has now been passed at your national level, provincial level, not local government. So it tries to resolve those conflicts, and it says that, first of all, when we read a provincial and a national act, we must try to avoid conflict. We must try and read them so that they can coexist. However, there are some conflicts that can occur. At the moment, I'm not aware of any specific thing that has occurred. But then, in Section 146, it says something very interesting. If we keep in mind what the definition usually of this act is, and it includes regulation, it says that an act made in terms of an act of Parliament, in other words, a regulation, can only prevail if the NCOP has approved it. So if we have a conflict between provincial and national acts, one can go through Section 146 and it sets out when provincial legislation will prevail and when national legislation will prevail. But it then says, if the conflict is a cause of your, or it implicitly says, if a conflict is caused by a regulation, although it forms part of this act, it cannot prevail unless the NCOP has approved it. So, I think one must just look at that and analyze it a bit, but I think just on the face of it says to me, when we're dealing with Section 76 legislation in Parliament, and we're allowing a delegation, we must seriously consider approval by Parliament of that, either by Parliament or just by the NCOP. But seeing that this is a joint committee, I think it could be Parliament. So I'm going to pause there. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Jenkins, for the information given. Honourable members, if you want to interrogate the presentation. Sorry, and then I'm not familiar with all your names.
I'm not sure.
Thank you.
No, I didn't listen that carefully to the enabling provision in the Constitution, but I take it that the fact that there hasn't been a committee like this one since the coming into operation of the Constitution will not have any effect on existing regulation and so on. We'll just clear that up.
Let's get the other. Before you respond, Honourable Bloom.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you very much to Advocate Jenkins. My question is a very short question. You are saying, say for instance, there is legislation passed already, say 2 or 3 years ago, but the regulations, an act is passed, but the regulations is not there, but the act is saying that there must be regulations. What is happening in such a case?
No, sir, thank you very much. I was going to follow up very much on that one. That says, because you spoke about Minister May and other areas where Minister must make regulations. And where she must, by default, it means that Parliament has oversight over those things. The question that I'm asking is, in those instances up to today, where it said it must, and you saying that we've had an application, are you saying that Parliament basically defaulted on its obligations up to that point? Or is it still open to challenge? I'm saying tomorrow some wise guy came up and says, if we go to the principle, it says the minister must, and Parliament has a duty to oversee according to Section 55 of the Constitution, no proof that it ever came back to Parliament. I'm saying, are we open in those instances from outside? What has been happening up to now? Because that's going to inform where we're going to, because it means that we might be opening a Pandora's box if some clever lawyer came out and said, well, in all those instances where they said it must, what has Parliament done? Are we exposed as Parliament? That's the question that I'm asking. Thanks, Chair.
There's
not
any other? Oh.
a question. If there is an overlap in the regulations between two departments, for example, the Department of Transport has got some regulations which might be in conflict with maybe the Department of Correctional Service legislation or regulations, do we have a role to play in terms of scrutiny there?
Thank you. Mr.
Jenkins,
you can respond.
Thank you.
And maybe before you do that, you realize that we don't have the presentation in our package here.
Yeah.
We don't have it.
Yeah,
maybe if it can make be made accessible to the members. In real part of this package, so we'll make sure that it's given to us. Okay, continue.
And that housekeeping, which, you know, I've got a what I call a note, a presentation note. I didn't make a PowerPoint presentation, and I've noticed it's not in the pack. I can even fill it up a bit, give it some meat, and distribute it. I'd like to just an Honourable Gahm's question: the validity of regulations prior to the coming into effect of this committee. No, it's no effect. This committee is not established as a constitutional mandate or imperative that you must have this committee. It implies it. You must have oversight mechanisms to look at things, including the implementation of legislation. And implementing legislation where it says you must do specific things, like making regulations, is certainly a function of Parliament. But what will make the regulation stand or fall is if that enabling provision says Parliament must approve. If Parliament didn't approve it, those regulations cannot be valid, full stop. If it says that it must be tabled, and it wasn't tabled, while assisting the committee, Advocate Masuto's committee at the time, it's clear that the courts will use a discretion. The tabling on its own, non-compliance with tabling, might not lead to the invalidation of regulations. So one could get away with that if you want to call it that, but certainly if there's an obligation to table and it wasn't tabled, you don't want to get away with it. You want to say to the executive, why did you not comply? Explain to us what is happening in the department. But it will not cause, for instance, if I think of gun laws or something like that, it won't cause a lacuna if you didn't table it, a vacuum in that regulatory framework. So whilst this is a committee established, 2012, and we started in 1997 with this constitution, there's no, on the face of it, from what I'm sitting here, there's no implications for regulations passed before this committee has come into operation, unless the enabling statute, as I indicated. An act, Honourable Bloom, the question of an act coming into operation and can't really come into operation unless the regulations are made. The Constitutional Court speaks there of a principle of rationality. If we think of the Immigration Act, which actually had all these transitional provisions and so on, but immigration, in any case, those transitional provisions and the transitional interim regulations were challenged unsuccessfully at the time, but they were challenged as well. But it's a good example because if the Act gives a power to a minister or a director general, and the director general can delegate those powers to immigration officials to allow or disallow someone to come into the country by the issuing of a visa. But the conditions to issue those visas will be prescribed, that's usually the words they use in the Act, will be prescribed by the minister. In other words, the minister must now prescribe regulations. What are the basis for refusing or allowing someone to come out of the country? But before that, minister can actually issue or prescribe those regulations. An immigration official hands out visas or refuses certain visas. And somebody takes that action to court. My knowledge or my studies of the Constitutional Court will say, well, this act, in fact, the signature by the President to bring this act into operation at the time, you know, there might be two signatures. One might be, I signed the act, I sent to the act, and it will come into a date proclaimed in the Government Gazette. And before, when the president issues that coming into effect on a certain date, and the regulations are not in place, the Constitutional Court will say it's an irrational act of the president. The president cannot bring an act into operation which gives certain powers to the minister or to the DG or officials if those DGs don't have the tools to do their work. That is what happened in the pharmaceutical case. The regulations were not there to classify and declassify medicine. The certain reference board was not established in terms of the regulations. So when the power was starting to be exercised over certain pricing of drugs, well, they call it drugs, but it's medicine actually, that was taken to court, and the judge, in terms of the Constitution, rightly said, well, you cannot bring that act into operation unless you have the ground of the regulations established. So that's the issue there. That's why transitional provisions is so important in these circumstances. We were not creating a new animal, but we're changing the colors of the leopard, for instance, and we make it a different kind of cat. The last question on overlapping. It's very interesting to read what was written on conflict between domestic laws in South Africa, whether it's different departments making regulations that overlap, or provinces and national, etc. We have had very few of these instances because of the political demographics of the country. I mean, they say it quite plainly, because of the overwhelming support of the ANC. So you have a system in place, a political system, where you don't have these problems that you get in federal countries. And we're not a federal country. And federal countries deal with this. In America, we've had numerous cases on this thing called Commerce Clause. Now, when there's those regulations, the Constitution is very amicable, if I can use that word. Yeah, it really wants to avoid conflict. And the test that certain authors have said is, can you obey both at the same time? Obey both.
Okay.
If you can obey both at the same time, it's no problem. But if you can't obey both at the same time, then there's a conflict. If you can't comply with the law, with a certain action, or you're complying with the one act, and at the same time you are transgressing the other law, then there's a conflict. Now, it would be for this committee to look, if those regulations must be tabled, for the committee to look at them and to say, well, here is a conflict, or even to receive the problem from whoever was dealing with it, and then to try and harmonize those. But as it stands at the moment, if there is a conflict or an apparent conflict, the Constitution tells us that we must try and harmonize it and see if both can apply. If it's between province and national, various tests are applied to determine which one will prevail. And the one that doesn't prevail is not struck down. It's not declared unconstitutional, invalid. It's just for that certain action, it's not written down. So it's not an invalidation of the thing. But it can happen. One can easily think of environmental issues and mining issues. Or we recently had a court case. We're dealing with the legislation now when it comes to land use, zoning of land use, and certain functions are now given to local government, but there were national legislation giving certain functions for provincial land tribunals. And this is being addressed in a new legislation before Parliament, so that can happen. Thank you.
I don't know, Mr. Jenkins, maybe Marina, if it might fall in your hand. I'm just trying to take a practical example. You know, what happens if a portfolio committee says the minister must make a regulation, and that regulation must come back to the portfolio committee? I'm using it as an example. Like the correctional services, medical, the parole board, medical body. And if in our deliberations later on, we say that all instances where the minister must come to this committee. I'm saying we're taking that isolated to what the portfolio committee is saying. One, are we duplicating work, or which committee then carries weight? Because what it means is that the portfolio committee would look at it, because they have said that in their portfolio committee. We said it in our committee, we look at it as well. One, we might be duplicating, but the more difficult one is what happens if the portfolio committee looks at it and agrees under their arrangement. We look at it and we disagree under our arrangement. What happens? So I'm asking, if it's going to fall under your one, then you don't have to answer it. You can cover that. And I'm just looking at it because we're talking about the conflicts. Thanks, Mr. Chen.
No,
it's a follow-up on the same thing. green before we pass this act in the committee. We agree that there will be regulations on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We are not putting this in there, in the act. We are going to have separate regulations, but covering the issues that we are discussing and agreeing on, and disagreement with the department. And say after 2 or 3 or a year, we hear nothing about this. And when the department come back, say, no, we are still busy with that. What is happening in such a case?
That first question, I'm going to leave to Marina, except to say that it's certainly, I mean, when we started discussing this with committees, with Ms. Kesman and Ms. Nene, it was an issue that was highlighted, if I remember correctly. We have this committee that's overlapping with portfolio committees, and we need to develop a system to get everything in place so that the House can take a single decision and not sit with conflicting reports. I think that's the question, but I think Marina is well placed for that. Just to add that if a committee gets obligation in terms of legislation, the joint group must first allow it. Usually we just keep it for Parliament. We try to not give committees a specific function, because committees are an extension of the House on the one hand, as well as got a mandate from the House. And if you give it a mandate in legislation, you're dealing with the House's power to establish committees and disestablish them. The question from Honourable Bloom, certainly if we've said to a minister, you must make regulations, and you haven't made those regulations, and they come back and they explain to you that it's been taking 3 years but we're still busy, one needs to know the reasons. There can be valid reasons. We're busy drafting regulations for the Financial Management of Parliament Act, 2012. It came into operation in 2009. So that's the 3 years you're talking about, but we're busy with them. It's taken a long time through various difficult questions and difficult issues, and there's a whole political process it must still go through. But there can be valid reasons for regulation making to take long. But it must be interrogated. Certainly it must be interrogated. One cannot just accept, well, they'll be busy and therefore we'll see you next year again. But it depends on the circumstances. There can also be a provision in the Enabling Act if you want. And this is stuff, very creative stuff that this committee can deal with. One can say in the Enabling Enactment that you must publish certain regulations within 30 days or within a year. And if they don't do that, then that power of delegation will fall away. Then Parliament makes its own, regulations, which could be a complicated thing as well. But there are ways of dealing with it. But you can't have an unreasonable delay in making regulations.
I was saying, let me say, Honourable Advocate is a former co-chairperson of this kind of a committee, and this is the report of the subcommittee that was there, and there are recommendations here in terms of how did they see them working, the committee of the. So it's recommendations. And we are established now. Does it mean that we move from the constitution as the clauses, the obtainment of the clauses, and maybe go through these recommendations, see ourselves taking this path forward? Maybe they should still to the recommendations and the resolutions and obviously are we going to be starting here in terms of how do you move forward and then come at a conclusion, not to recommendations and not to conclusion. Thank you.
But before you start, I just want to answer this one. Ma'am, the subcommittee that Advocate Mr. Tako chaired was a different committee for a different purpose. What that committee did was to look at a mechanism, which is now what you are. They created or they proposed this mechanism to do the scrutiny. So they were just looking at all the technical aspects and looking at different jurisdictions and, you know, what was required and in terms of lawness. So they proposed what we now see before us as this interim. At the moment it's an interim structure, but I'll explain just now why it's an interim structure. But so they were a different kind of committee. And those recommendations, I'll also address to you when I speak to you on the rules and things. I'll also speak to you specifically about the recommendations in the report as well.
Yeah, honourable members, I think this is work in progress. We are all new to this, and we want to thank you at Advocate Jenkins and believe that we still have to engage, because really, to some of us without the legal mind, it may take us longer to really understand what is our mandate in this committee. But we hope that, as even there were suggestions that we need to have legal experts to assist us in this committee, but those will be followed up as we continue and we work as a committee and see where we need which assistance. But thank you very much for the light you shared with us. Thank you. We, honourable members, we now go to review of rules. We'll start with Marina. Am I calling it correct?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Marina.
honourable chairs and honourable members. If you don't mind, I don't have a law degree either, but I hope I'm having my drama degree to help me through this one. So, and even though I don't have a law degree, I just did manage to draft this report, so we'll all get through it, I think. It was 10 years ago, so I'm a bit rusty, but if members don't mind, I'm not going to do a formal kind of presentation, but I think it's best if we talk to the issue, because we need to understand what needs to happen here. The first thing I just quickly want to look at, and members have the presentation in printed format with them, because the computer is not working. Here we go. Okay. I just wanted to tell you what the original intent was with the interim status. Jesse phoned me earlier today and said, how can she get rid of this interim thing? I said to her, I'm sorry, you can't.
Not yet.
Not yet. The idea in 2002 was that while this subcommittee on delegated legislation was looking at mechanisms of conducting scrutiny of delegated legislation, Parliament would in the meantime establish an interim mechanism to start doing the work on a limited scale, and you'll notice once we get to the rules that the work of the committee at this stage is still limited. It can be expanded, but at this stage, the scope of the committee is not yet so big. But of course, when the subcommittee proposed and when the rules committee took a decision to establish this interim committee, they did not envisage it taking 10 years before the committee was actually established. And it is now, we're celebrating a decade since the report was drafted and this initial decision was taken. So basically I'm just explaining why it's an interim measure. And when the Joint Rules Committee took the decision to actually now establish the structure, it also said that they're doing it on a trial period. I think Mr. De Lange at the meeting mentioned a period of about 2 years. Because it's going to take time. We need to find our feet with this. It's the first time we're doing this. Some other parliaments, particularly in the UK, New Zealand, Australia, they're quite established as far as scrutiny of delegated legislation is concerned. But it's our first effort at doing this. And the other reason was that while the committee was doing some of this, while the committee, the interim committee, would be doing the scrutiny, there would be a committee looking at standard setting legislation. I think Advocate Masito referred to the fact that you need norms and standards, and the whole idea was, and you'll see it runs like a vein through this particular report, is that there should be standard setting legislation. In most countries, apparently there is. Standard setting legislation, these are the norms and standards for the tabling of particular delegated instruments. This is how you do regulations, this is what you need to do for that. And as Mr. Smith was saying as well, that might be something that this committee would look at. However, you would not be responsible for drafting such kind of legislation, because if that's not within your mandate, unless the House gave it to you. But what you could do was to, if you find in the course of the next few months or so that that kind of legislation is required, and that would help the committee and assist the committee in performing its function, we would have to see how far along we go and how long you operate before we actually decide, okay, now we need legislation. So legislation is quite drastic and final. So once you get there, I think then you're already saying, but this is a more permanent structure than just an interim thing. So the cart before the horse, we'll have to see about that particular process. So that's the other reason why this is an interim structure. Don't feel too badly about it. You still have a very important work, and I, for one, am very grateful that this thing is at last getting off the ground. But I do think there's going to be a lot of testing of the waters and trying out certain things and trying out certain procedures. I'll explain to you just now when we start looking at the rules and things what still needs to be clarified. And there are, unfortunately, quite a few sticky and tricky things that need to be done. As far as the powers of the committee, okay, the rules in the first place, they establish the committee, they say there shall be an interim joint committee on scrutiny of delegated legislation. Then they give the composition of the committee, which was initially quite problematic for committee six, and I know they were battling with the 9 and the 5, making it 14 members. Is that correct? I think 14 members. The whole idea behind this committee was that it's a technical committee, so you're going to need sort of people who can sit down with something quite technical and deal with it, but a small group so that you don't battle all the time. And because there are time frames involved in a lot of the work that you'll be doing, to battle to get a quorum and to get a meeting together and whatever is not feasible for this particular committee. This committee needs to be able to meet, and that's why it was kept the same size as, well, at that stage, the size of a portfolio committee in the National Assembly. So that's the reason why we did that. Also because you didn't necessarily in this case need a representative from each province. I think I'll leave the NCOP stuff to my colleagues to speak, because they're far more about the NCOP than I am. I am not at all. Okay, but then it goes into the functions and powers of this committee. Now, basically, you have the same general powers as joint committees have. So you'll be able to have the same kind of conferral, if you want to confer with other committees, you'll be able to do that, calling for papers, all the general kinds of powers that joint committees have, you'll also have. Then it goes into what you are supposed to do. Now, this is your mandate. You must then, in accordance with the criteria identified in the interim rule, the beetles have not been written into the rule book yet, they're by resolution of the houses, so they are interim rules at this particular point. But they have the force of rules in terms of the parliamentary context. So there are basically three things that you need to scrutinize. The first one is delegated legislation, 103, which requires approval by Parliament for it to enter into force. Then delegated legislation which Parliament may disapprove, thus invalidating it. And thirdly, which requires consultation with Parliament. So those, you're limited to that, to those delegated instruments. In other words, you don't have to look at all regulations that come through Parliament. You don't have to look at all notices and all proclamations and all things. You only have to do it in the cases where it requires approval before it can enter into force. In cases where Parliament may disapprove it, this thereby invalidating it, and where it requires consultation with Parliament. And I'll refer to this one just now in a different context. Then the second thing that you need to scrutinize will be delegating provisions in bills before their formal consideration by the House. Now, these are bills, either Section 76 or Section 75, introduced, in other words, all the new bills coming in. You will be required to look at the delegating provisions in those bills, if they have them, of course, if they are delegating provisions. And then, as a last option, this was put in at the joint rules meeting, which I think is a good thing. It gives you a discretion where it was added that if there's other delegated legislation that the committee decides needs to be looked at, if there's a problem with something else, the committee can actually decide that it wants to look at delegated legislation that does not necessarily fall within within 1A or 1B. So basically you can then decide to look at that. When it comes to the types of delegated legislation that is referred to in A, in other words, that requires approval or can be disapproved, invalidating it, or which requires consultation, there's a very, very useful instrument that has been created. It's called the Audit of Statutes. It is at the moment up to date up to the end of 2010 and will soon be up to date until the end of 2011. Now, what the Audit of Statutes is a guide to Parliament's obligations under the Constitution and all other legislation. In other words, it identifies all the duties and functions assigned either to Parliament, to the NA, to the NTOP, to committees of the House. In all those instances, you will have all the duties and functions that Parliament must perform. And that includes, there's a section also on delegated legislation. There we go. You'll see there's the section of the Audit of Statutes that is about delegated legislation. And 2.1.1, delegated legislation that Parliament must approve for it to enter into force. 2.1.2, which it must disapprove, that's by invalidating it. And then the third one, which requires consultation with Parliament. So those are exactly the things that this committee will be tasked with. In other words, if things come through, they will be coming through in particular, it will be in the Audit of Statutes, and that will assist this committee in dealing with those particular instruments. The one thing that I need to mention, what is useful about this particular thing is that it not only identifies the function, it has a hyperlink, it's available electronically, and links you electronically to the exact provision in the Act. In other words, exactly what the Act is, identifies the function, describes it, and then it links you to the provision in the Act. So that's just a useful thing that members can use when it comes to the delegated instrument, to the secondary legislation. Then when we talk about, and this is where we start with the problems. I think I skipped the thing here. There are a few things that we need to note when it comes, and these are practical problems that I've thought about these things, and I just picked up on these practical things. The committee can look at it and decide how it can be dealt with, either in your guidelines or in your operational guidelines and in your functioning. There'll have to be some kind of liaison between the committee and the relevant portfolio or select committees about the time frames for reporting, because your reporting requirements are that when you've looked at delegated legislation, at the piece, you know, other regulations or what it is that you need to look at, you report to the House. And that was done on purpose by the subcommittee where they wanted to avoid this committee having to report to a portfolio committee or to a select committee, because the opinion of this committee will be important to what the portfolio committee eventually puts in its report to the House, or the select committee to its report in the House. But this committee publishes its report for information, and it is there then for the portfolio committee and the select committee to use and apply. But it's published there for the information of everyone, so that it cannot be ignored. We all know that there are sometimes tensions between committees and things like that, and it was discussed at the subcommittee level and said that what if there is tension between a particular portfolio committee and this committee, and the portfolio committee was not necessarily happy with, you know, what was said. But the fact that it's published in the ATC, that it's there for all members of the House to see, the House eventually has to take a decision on a particular matter, so it will then see whether this committee's recommendations were incorporated into the final report of the committee. So, but there will have to be some kind of liaison between your committee and the portfolio select committee dealing with this particular issue. Because, look, you're scrutinizing according to certain criteria. You're not looking at policy issues. The portfolio committee and select committee, they're looking at the policy issues in terms of how it affects the operations of the department and of how the ministry is performing, things like that. Those things, they will look at that. You are just you are scrutinizing according to the criteria set up before. You know, whether it complies with this and complies with that, whether it's procedural, whether it's, you know, retrospective nature, whether it conforms with the objects of the Parent Act, et cetera, et cetera, all those things, which hopefully your legal advisors will assist you with, because I'm not even going to try and explain what they mean by purport. It's a nice book. But I'll have to get the dictionary for that one. So basically what I'm saying is that the portfolio committee will have to reply, will have to report. They are the ones who report at some stage on the regulations and things. So there will just have to be some kind of liaison so that your report is not published after the fact. So that your report is published timeously for the portfolio committee to also consider your recommendations if you have any regarding this particular thing. Because if they want to adopt these regulations and they say it's fine, and the Cliff Committee says no, but it's unconstitutional, or it's, haven't been properly drafted, or they're trespassing on personal rights and liberties and whatever, then there must be some way for the portfolio to incorporate the committee's recommendations. So, these are the kind of things that I'm talking about that will come out on a practical level that you'll have to talk about. The other thing that has already been mentioned is that many delegated instruments have specific time frames attached. They must be sort of the act says that the regulations must be based. They come into force 30 days after they've been tabled in the National Assembly and things like that. The program of Parliament, constituency periods, recess periods, they'll have to be very careful monitoring and liaison between the departments, the things coming in for tabling and whatever. So one will have to find a way of this committee keeping track of what is coming in and what the time frames involved are in regard to those specific things, where there are time frames before they can come in, before they have enter into force. One thing, it's just something that I picked up recently because I'm sitting with two examples of it on my table at the moment. I think the only one I've got the one. Is where on draft regulations, the Act requires the Minister to consult with Parliament beforehand on regulations. Now, obviously, that consultation will now also include this committee if it's something that has to be approved. But if it says that they have to consult, then, it's one of the requirements that we say it will have to come to this committee. But what they often do is before they allow it to publish in the Gazette and before it can become part of, before the proclamation is published in the Gazette, okay. But what happens is that the process is in the case of, we've got social development regulations now, and I've got some police ones as well, where there wasn't consultation, there was consultation, but informal with the MA. There was nothing tabled and referred and a formal process. Same, and they never consulted with the NCOP at all. And then the minister writes back and says, okay, this is published in the Gazette, and there was consultation with Parliament. So that's the kind of thing that this committee ought to be picking up on when that happens. So when they finally submitted to Parliament, say, okay, these are now the regulations, and we have consulted with Parliament, this committee will say, where did this consultation take place? Was it formal? Because if the Act requires consultation, it means it has to be tabled and it has to be referred, like a formal, and there has to be a report on that, etc. So these are just some of the things that I've picked up on in regard to this particular thing. I'm talking about delegating provisions in the original legislation. I think we've already said enough here about the fact that, I'll start picking up on the problems and then you'll see what I mean. The fact that from now on, bills that come in that have delegating provisions, this committee will have to look at the delegating provisions. Now, the stage at which it looks at those provisions is a problem. I'll explain it to you now. And I think we also just need to give consideration to the fact that how the committee wants to deal with the fact that it's only now established, but these rules have actually been in place for about 4 or 8 months, and the committee's only becoming operational now, and there have been some bills with serious delegation provisions, which one I'm referring to. I'm actually talking about the state information bill, but the thing's real name. That thing has got some quite serious delegation provisions, but I mean, what the rule says is that before it goes before the House of Formal Consideration, the delegating provisions must be scrutinized by this committee. Now, the committee needs to decide whether it's only going to start looking at stuff that comes in from now on onwards, or whether it's going to actually look at from the time that these rules became operational, which was September last year, that's about 8 months now, the stuff that came in since these rules are in force. Because the House adopted the resolution without, before we were quite ready to sort of put the committee right there and say, off you go, and do your work.
I realize that maybe there's some nodding by the members. We said it's very informal. Don't wait for her to finish the presentation. If you want clarity, can just come in.
Yeah. Okay, I'm almost done. Okay, once again, problems. And this is my last one, because the last one is on the role of the NCOP, and that advocate Jacob has already addressed, and my colleagues here on my left are more than beyond competent to do. Quickly, just as far as we're now talking about both the delegating provisions, the problems that I've thought about that haven't been addressed yet. Firstly, who identifies the delegating provisions in the bill to be introduced? Can that just be the bills office? I've thought about possibly the joint tagging mechanism, and I'll tell you why I'm saying that is because they also, there's a provision in the traditional, what is that thing called? The joint tagging mechanism also identifies whether there are, whether the a bill has to go to the House of Traditional Leaders for consultation. So it would also not, if the legal advisors are the ones who look at the bills that come in, so they could just as well say, okay, there are delegating provisions in this bill, so it must go to the scrutiny committee as well. That's just one that I thought of. But at the moment, there's no decision on that yet, on when and who gets to do that. Once again, at what point is the bill referred to the joint committee on scrutiny? Because do we know when it's introduced? It can be done. And then they must report according to terms of the rules just before the House does the formal consideration. So in the case of the NA, it would be the second reading. In the case of the NCOP, it would be before the debate on the bill and before it comes to the second House. The problem is just, if they consider it right at the beginning, what if the portfolio committee amends the delegating provisions? How do you? That will need to be managed in some or other way. Or should this committee only look at it just before the portfolio committee is ready to report on the bill? Would that not cause delays? I'm sorry, but this yes, I'm sorry, but this is the kind of thing that we just need to. It needs to be managed, and the committee needs to work out how it can best be done. When you look at your operational guidelines, I think those are the types of things that you need to look at. Then once again, if the committee, this is a joint committee, so it will report to both houses, but what is the second house? If the second house can amend, what if they decide to amend the delegating provision before it sounds right? Do you then have to again look at the thing? We need to look at whether how we're going to manage that particular process. And then also the committee needs to decide at what point, if necessary, you don't have to do it. Will you confer with the relevant portfolio or the select committee? There'll probably have to be some kind of interaction, but whether it needs to be formal kind of sit-down interaction or whether it can just be a report from the committee and that kind of thing one can look at. And I think that you will find out as you go along what is the easiest and what makes the work of the committee easier. Because I think that's the idea, is to get this thing running as smoothly as possible. Just the last thing I asked was, who's the final arbiter of the committee's recommendations? In other words, how will it be enforced? Can they be enforced? The fact is, at this point, In this interim report, we talked to the issue of, is this a senior committee compared to portfolio and select committees? And so in other words, do the recommendations of this committee carry such weight that they will basically compel the portfolio committee to do whatever, follow whatever the recommendation is that they give, relating to the particular scrutiny criteria that you have? Obviously, you're not looking at policy issues, so you won't, it won't be on those issues, but on these things, on constitutionality and those kinds of things, how are you going to enforce that? So one needs, relationships will develop as the committee goes along. I'm going to be optimistic as we go along, but it will happen eventually. It has to happen because Parliament, this is an important oversight mechanism, and I think if we can get it working, it will be fantastic. So, and just the other thing then, time frames. Just we need to just keep time frames in mind. Just as far as also with these things. The time frames for bills, when bills speak, you know, the 3-day rule, must there be an additional rule now to say that once the committee has adopted the legislation, that they must look at it again, or before the committee adopts the legislation, you know, there must be a stalling period of, say, 5 a week or whatever before, so that this committee can look at those things. Those are just all the kind of things that this committee will at some stage need to discuss and work out and find the best way around. And I'm sure that Sandele is ready to assist. We are, if we can. I mean, we'll be ready to, if you need us, we'll be ready to assist you. I'm sorry, I'm not being very, very helpful on the rules. I think I've made you more despondent now. But as I said, the rules limit what you need to do, but it's still a huge job, and there are still some important things that need to be sorted out. Thank you,
Marina. I'm not sure, Marina, whether I'm going to assist you or I'm causing more challenges to your presentation. You referred to the fact that there should be some kind of liaison between the committees, and the liaison is not prescribed in the interim rules. Currently, there's a challenge around contrarians between committees. You refer to the private members committee. There are a lot of issues that committee is trying to contend with other committees, and the conferral is not happening. So how this committee is going to make sure that it confers with other committees? Because the principal act that has the enabling provision that Marina, Advocate Jenkins referred to, will be processed and passed by another committee. But now the regulations are referred to this committee. Will this committee have to confer with the committee that passed the principal act? And if that is the case, is the conferral going to be obligatory or is going to be discretionary? I heard Marina refer to the ATC to say that the portfolio committee, relevant portfolio committee, must look at the ATC. Mm-hmm. In reality, members don't have time, all of them, to look at the ATC. What if the members of the relevant portfolio committee did not see the report in the ATC and they don't have time to make comments to the report of this committee?
Okay, just in terms of the conferral is not obligatory at this stage. And remember that the regulations get referred to both committees. They get referred to your committee to look at in terms of these specific criteria that are outlined in the interim rules. They get referred to the portfolio committee to look at in terms of policy issues and whether the minister is doing what they wanted the minister to do as far as the regulations are concerned and as far as the department is concerned. So the report of the committee will be published. Of this committee will be published in the ATC for the information of all members, and I think it's not always, I mean, it is for the members to pick up, but I mean, the committee secretary to the portfolio committee will hopefully pick up on the report, and I mean, one can also arrange that a copy of the report goes to the portfolio committee. I mean, that I think that can be arranged. That's not an insurmountable problem. But yeah, the as I said, the conferral is not obligatory. It's because you're looking at specific issues. I mean, and which is or things that the portfolio committee will not be looking at. If there's a good working relationship between committees, and if you have a good, I mean, they can always. It does not need to be formal. It can be emails. Email is a very good tool. Do it on Facebook if it works. Anything that works, I always say. No, I'm being facetious now, but what I'm saying is that it does not need to be in terms of formal notes in the ADC published and then to and fro and formal meetings with minutes and things like that. It can be chairperson's meeting and saying, this is what we think, this is what we want to do, etc., and reporting back to your respective committees.
No, thank you. We must also note that you are not doing well in terms of time, but we need to get clarity. Present us, assist us by, you know, being to the point. The first hand was from Ms. Nuba, followed by Honorable Bloom, Honorable Kai. Any other? Oh, okay.
Thank you.
No, thanks. I'm saying this document has been accepted. You are saying?
No, this is just a presentation. The rules.
Yeah.
If you look at the last two pages of that presentation, it contains the actual rules that were, those are the rules that were adopted by the NCOP and the MA. It should be on the last two pages of that presentation.
Okay, no, fine. I have just come to find out. The approval of the
okay.
We normally hear ministers say this thing has been tabled and approved by cabinet, and then from cabinet then goes to the portfolio. So where we stand with them? When it is over, at whatever level, should be something. Also, the question of temperance we are talking about. At NA level, there is no temperance. You can deal with the bill for 3 months, for 5 months. We have a temperance at the institution. Must deal with that thing in the 60s. Now, it goes back to the question of where do you come in? If with us you say there's recess, there's whatever, those things are being dealt. You can't call a person back to Parliament and say it is now the fourth week. That process, you don't count it if the bill extends to the recess I'm just emphasizing on the approval time of it and the time frame. This report also talks about, we are saying we need to have support staff or technical people like any other company. So there was the intent maybe between the NA secretary and the NCOP secretary, or between the two teams, then that's where maybe you can come in terms of them tracking. But it's not impossible, I think, because when ministers table the bill in Parliament, it is to the relevant portfolio, which then means we need to affect ourselves into a situation relevant to the coming. Thank you.
Ma'am, you're quite right in the sense that they once the cabinet has approved and the minister, when the minister intends to introduce the bills, we have what we call a JR Joint Rule 159 process, where a draft bill is submitted plus an explanatory memo. So at that particular stage, it gets sent to the portfolio committee, so that the portfolio committee can actually answer, well, it's the late committee, it's 7-6, but it's for them to determine what the bill is about, how long they think it will take them to deal with this particular thing. And at that stage, it could be for the delegating to, you know, then also be then referred to this committee. When at the draft law stage, that it can also come to this committee. But once again, it will have to be determined when will be the most effective point for the committee to come in, because at that particular early stage, you're still not taking care of things like what if the portfolio committee amends the delegating provision. You see that you have that particular problem. And as far as the timeframes are concerned, it's difficult to say at this stage, because the regulation will say that 30 days after being tabled in Parliament, or 30 days after submission to Parliament or something like that, and maybe there should be a kind of an understanding between the Department and Parliament that things don't get tabled. We never used to have ATCs in recess periods or in constituency periods because members weren't here to deal with issues. Now, lately, because we sit, you know, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, et cetera, we don't really have that break anymore for the ATCs, and we sort of just assume that the secretaries are passing on to members. But maybe that kind of thing should come back then again and say that those things don't get tabled in a recess, so that the time frames then only kick in. But that will depend on what the enabling provision says about the time frames, how we determine what the time frames are. We'll have to look at practical examples to be able to determine exactly how we're going to handle that kind of thing. At the moment, there's no, because it hasn't happened before. There's no. It says that the committee must look at delegating provisions and bills, but at this particular point, the regulations are easy. Once they're tabled, they get referred to the committee, because the regulations are secondary to legislation, so they get tabled on a particular date, and we refer it immediately to the relevant portfolio committee and to the scrutiny committee, if it falls within the ambit of the stuff that you have to look at.
No, because of time, I think we'll look into that again. Honourable Blue?
Well, thank you very much. I must confess, I am more dear Makaru now. I was listening to Martina, but I can't get the function and the duty and role of this committee. Does this committee have powers or what? You see, it will clash with other committees. You have said it yourself. Now, I don't understand. You know, Chairperson, maybe we must have a week to understand this thing, this whole thing. Because this thing, to me, I was trying to listen to the presentation. But honestly, Marina, I've also asked questions to this thing. That is my input. I don't have a question.
before I get to the others, do you have this document?
I'm having it.
Everybody has it. Now, as she was presenting, I was telling myself, now it's becoming work. But we'll talk about it, and maybe we still need a follow-up. And that says, even now, we are really, I'm feeling that people are tired. They've been working the whole day. We'll see how we go about on that one. Honorable King?
Uh-huh.
You can. Go.
Go, Chair. Yes, I think some of these, obviously this is, as has been said, work in progress. It's establishing something for the first time. So there are unresolved questions that we need to get recommendations, also from the officials and from our legal people. There are one or two of these matters that may be resolved in a legal manner quite easily. For example, off the cuff, one could look at the specific provisions, but if this committee has been established in terms of the rules at a certain date, it hasn't really been established, as I understand, the rules have been, came into operation, and then the rules say that there must be a committee like that, like this, it must be established, then it seems to me that only when it is established, eventually it can start dealing with matters. for example. But I mean, that's a matter that can be resolved legally. I don't know whether Advocate Jenkins would want to give an opinion straight away on that. But I mean, you know, some of these matters need some reflection, it seems to me, and then we need to have specific recommendations, and then obviously we need to take decisions as to how we're going to deal with it in terms of process, at what stage bills should be referred here, at what stage we should really look at it. It can also be referred, for example, to us simultaneously when it is referred to the portfolio committee, but we don't have to necessarily look at it already at that point. We can just take notice of it, and then only when the portfolio committee tells us, okay, we are now ready to put it before the House or whatever, then we really look at what they have decided, and then we have our legal experts and so on giving us opinions on it, and then we can take our decisions. Because it seems to me that this committee is actually more about look at these things from a legal perspective than anything else in the final analysis. So just a comment from Melissa.
No, I think you are very correct. That is why we are saying we need to have follow up on what we have today. And all those suggestions and the questions that you are putting in, I think they will be answered when we discuss them. Let me not give to you. Okay. Okay.
No, I just want to say, as we've gone said now, remember that the spade work for the committee will be done by hopefully your legal expert that you'll have. They'll go through all the things for you and only bring up if there's a problem. When the committee meets, they'll be sitting down and saying, be presented with a report to say, there's a problem in this particular area, and there's a problem in this particular area, and there's a problem in this area. Or there are no problems with this particular thing, we can adopt it as is, and that is how we will report. So hopefully the committee will not be burdened with having to wade through every single thing that comes to the committee. Members will obviously want to familiarize themselves a bit with stuff, but the legal spade work will hopefully be done by your support staff.
Thank you, Chair. I'm honored. And good afternoon, honorable members. I hope that I'm not going to create even more confusion, honorable. Because I think there's a need that this committee should reconvene and then carefully look at the rules in terms of which it is going to operate. Because if one looks at the rules and the manner in which they are drafted, they make a distinction between delegated legislation and delegating provisions.
Mm.
And it appears to me that the drafters intended to draw a distinction between the two. And it appears to me that insofar as the scrutiny criteria of delegated legislation, to be delegated legislation might be regulations. And a delegating provision, for instance, would be a provision in a bill which authorizes the executive to prescribe certain matters in terms of regulation. So that's why I'm saying that it appears to me that there's a distinction between the two. And it appears to me that that was the intention of the drafters. If, for instance, one looks at rule two, if I were to refer to it as rule two, which authorizes the committee to scrutinize delegated legislation, firstly that requires approval by Parliament for it to enter into force. Which Parliament may disapprove, thus invalidating it, and that requires consultation with Parliament. Honorable Masood, I think, has referred to these provisions, and his question was whether this committee will only be authorized to scrutinize the delegated legislation only if the principal legislation requires that Parliament should approve that legislation for it to come into effect. or which requires a consultation with Parliament. My colleagues have referred to some regulations which were drafted by the Department of, I think, Female Settlement, and which intended the regulations to take effect. But in terms of the principal act, the requirement was that Parliament must be consulted. And when we checked, we realized that there was no consultation with Parliament, and therefore, in our view, the regulations could not come into effect until such time that there was consultation. And it appears that it appears to me that 2B, which refers to delegating provisions in bills before their formal consideration by the House, it appears to me that any bill that has a provision which authorizes the executive to come up with the regulation, it should be submitted, that provision or those provisions should be submitted to this committee for scrutiny. If one proceed now to the scrutiny criteria, in Rule 4, for instance, refers to delegated legislation. And it appears to me that the committee has broader grounds on which to scrutinize the delegated legislation. And for instance, 4B refers to whether they comply with procedural aspects pertaining to delegated legislation. I'm not sure if we do have such procedural, the procedure pertaining to delegated legislation. It may be that that procedure still needs to be developed. Then if one proceeds to 4.2 on the rules, 4.2 relates to delegating provisions in bills, and it appears to me that this committee may only scrutinize those delegating provisions on those narrow grounds. According to the rules, there are only three grounds on which the committee may scrutinize delegating provisions in the bill. And if one proceeds to the reporting, for instance, the reporting, which is Rule 5, for the sake of convenience, it says upon completion of the scrutiny, I'm going to read it out so that it becomes very clear. It says upon completion of the scrutiny process, it appears to me that it's for both processes now. It's for delegating provisions as well as delegated legislation. The committee, meaning this committee, shall report its findings to the House for information of the relevant portfolio or select committee and other members. And in view of the provisions of Section 146 of the Constitution, specifically report to the National Council of Provinces on delegated instruments relating to matters contained in Schedule 4. So it appears to me that it may well be that the committee must report to the House even before. If there's a committee, another committee that is dealing with legislation, even before that committee has finalized. Because it would be for information of the relevant portfolio committee and the select committee, as well as for other members. Because it may well be also that the committee that is dealing with, which I may call the main committee, which is dealing with the principal legislation, may have to satisfy itself also as to whether the provisions of the delegated legislation comply with the provisions of the principal legislation. So that is why I would propose that maybe this committee should reconvene and carefully look at the rules, and perhaps if the rules require amendment, we shall meet with our colleagues and see as to whether we may propose amendment to the rules if need be. So that if the rules also require the amendments, then they can be amended and then be submitted to the Houses for approval. So, Chair, I do not want to venture into the interpretation of Section 146 of the Constitution, I'm sure we can deal with that at a later stage. I will just pause the chair. Thank you.
Maybe what I should say is that the gap that you have already now identified, when we reconvene, you must already have them to make sure that we tighten it up. We don't start from scratch and start debating. Members, do you have anything? No, we'll leave them. Mrs. Kessler, please, I think we are going to present global best practices from the research. I just tell us which countries won. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. When the JRC decided to establish this mechanism, the Secretary asked us to look at, because there's no precedent to learn from for this committee, where else can we look at? We started then a desktop exercise to see what is being done elsewhere. And also we communicated with officials in some of the parliaments. We didn't look in all parliaments, but we looked in certain specific parliaments, some of which were looked at by Professor Korda when he was working with the subcommittee that Advocate Masuda was talking about. Perhaps I should not say what each parliament does on those that we looked at. Safe to say, when we look compared what the various provisions are, we identified a few parliaments that we thought this committee might want to look in detail in terms of what they do and the procedures that they've set for themselves. Unfortunately, some of the parliaments that we were referred to by colleagues in those parliaments didn't have much in terms of what is published. But they said, you probably will learn more if your committee interacts with our committees, rather than you have some don't have written down procedures for you to look at. But we looked at Australia, and most of the Commonwealth parliaments that we talked to referred us to the Australian practice as the best practice. UK, for instance, said ours merely is limited to looking at, to the same extent as this committee, to the legal issues around delegated legislation, rather than going on to policy, whether there's merit on this policy or not. But they pointed us to Australia as being a practice that you could learn from. And there were issues around the Canadian system where they were saying now Canada is experiencing political issues around secession and all of that, and that impact on their ability to do some of the work, and therefore maybe it's not something that you want to look at, but it is there. They have a system of scrutinizing the delegated legislation like we seek to. Then we looked at the Indian Parliament and we talked to the people who work there as well. And they look at everything. They look at bylaws, they look at the rules, they look at schemes, they look at various number of statutory instruments. And they also require that all of those should be in their language laid before the House or in our table. And in addition to that, not only that, they also look at what the committee may decide they want to look at, which may not necessarily have been tabled, and they can then demand that it be tabled. But when we looked at their system, we thought perhaps it's a system that the committee might want to look at because it looked as though it functions more or less the same way as us, where there are two houses which are not which not have the upper house as other parliaments have, but have instead the House of the People, which is equivalent to the National Assembly, and the Council of States, which is equivalent to the National Council of Provinces. So we thought that might be an example that you want to look at, but we can give you details as to how they deal what procedures they put in place. In Africa, Chair, the colleagues that we talked to pointed us to Zambia as being having an effective system. But their effectiveness we couldn't really understand because we didn't find a logical conclusion as to what happens then to a regulation when it doesn't get favor in Parliament. It looked as though it wasn't clear as to what they do, but as I say, other colleagues in the African Parliament that we talked to pointed us to Zambia as a system we could go and have a look at. And Chairperson, why I thought that perhaps it's advisable that we present this to the committee at this stage was the thinking that was shared at the level of House Chairpersons of Committees, that perhaps this committee, different from others, might want to begin at learning how this function is performed elsewhere rather than starting to do the work. Because with other committees, they first begin with understanding their mandate and starting to do the work and then say, maybe we should go and compare with other people elsewhere. Because there is already established practices, there are precedents to look at and refer to. But in this particular instance, there is nothing that this committee can learn from, and therefore perhaps it would be best to look outside. That is why, as my recommendation that I have included in the slide, is that perhaps the committee might want to consider to first go and learn so that it, even when it develops its own procedures, it has a basis to work from. Thank you, Chairperson. I've tried to summarize. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kessler, and we believe that we have the document that shows different countries for interaction and the last remark. I'll now take it to my co-chairperson. We can continue for the interaction.
Is this an interaction? I thought it was for information. Mr. Blue?
Chairperson, thank you very much. This presentation has at least given me relief. That's what our wife. No. Honestly, you know, you can't start with a thing that you don't know. And I think that Ms. Keswa is 100% correct. Let us not rush into this thing. Let us first learn how other countries are doing this thing before we are creating more problems for Parliament and going into and having a lot of tension and whatever. I fully want to support what Ms. Keswa is saying. That is really relief for me. Thank you very much.
No, I'm saying we must go to Zimbabwe and what is it?
Zambia.
No, there's no other overseas.
No, that's fine. Colleagues, thank you very much. Let's just remind you that this was a session for information gathering for ourselves. I do think, members, we, certainly as we were going through, I have noted a few things that I think at a political level we have discussed ourselves. Deadlock-breaking mechanism, for instance, not just between this committee and portfolio, but this committee, I mean, NCOP and NA, all those types of things at the political level that we have to debate in the first instance. We've identified them. We will send a notification out saying these are the issues that we've identified then in our discussion. We'll also give issues that we think you guys can help us with. So then, for instance, the follow-up on the Concord ruling. and certain things we've been asked you. But I do think that going forward, at a political level, we'll have a discussion. We'll call you guys in at some point to clarify those other things that you're talking about and take it from there. Mr. Bloom, I just need to indicate that we'll take whatever Mr. Kessler is saying in that meeting, because you might be correct, Mr. Kessler, saying that maybe we must go and learn first. But somebody earlier said that there is some legislation that is currently before us. If we don't act upon, we'll bring serious problems. So do we learn for 6 months and risk? So I'm saying those discussions we will have, but we've taken everything into consideration. Once again, to our resource people, thank you very much. Just an indication from members. We have said when we started that we've agreed that we'll work after hours. The question is, should we try and do this next step next week, or do we want a week's break, or what is it that we want? Because I think between the three of us, we'll try and disturb what has come out, give it to you, maybe give you a week to look after it, and look after a fortnight. I'm just looking for you from indication. Do we meet next week or in a fortnight? Fortnight. All right. What we will do, we'll try and do this together with our resource people. You'll have a week to distill it in your political parties or in your own time. And we will schedule a meeting for 2 weeks from today. Same venue, same time. We will have a discussion and try and tighten some of these things up. Is that okay? Thank you very much. We also, let us just indicate that we're not going to adopt minutes at this point, because we're really just exploring. So you mustn't expect any minutes out of these things. What will come is reports that between the three of us will generate and give you. Meeting is adjourned until a fortnight. Sorry. Carry on, Chair.
Before that, there is the transport issue for those who are traveling by bus. Jesse says, she sent notification to ask if people will need transport and nobody responded. It's on email. I was just telling her that, you know, with us. Okay. Yeah. So please, if there is anybody who really needs transport. Oh, there's Gina in the old assembly, you are invited.
Yeah, this is the late one, right?